Welcome to the What's Happening sound of Monitor for Sunday evening, November 5th. I'm Jack Haskell, minding the store for your regular host, Brad Crandall. And later this half hour, Mel Allen with all of today's news and sports, plus a look at the week ahead. And 3 minutes away, actor James Stewart on location in Utah tells us why he thinks movies are here to stay.
It just happened yesterday, yet it seems it came my way before. Darling, I swear I felt the lips on mine at least 1,000 times or more. Darling, we walked in the sun and we laughed when it rained on our dreams. And now it's all coming true. I've got you, girl, no wonder it seems. I've spent a lifetime loving you. I've spent a lifetime loving you.
Of Vic Dana on Monitor.
This is Ed McMahon. For my next act, I'm going to tell you all about a beauty product. Well, don't laugh, because I really know what I'm talking about. It's a shampoo, a really good concentrate shampoo. It's made by the Breck people. It's called Breck Concentrate, not surprisingly, and it's what you might call a family shampoo. My wife Alice found it first for us, and being concentrated, just a little goes a long, long way and makes plenty of lather. Not a bad idea with a bunch of kids around like ours. And being Breck, it's a very good shampoo, full of conditioners and all those things. So it even suits baby fine hair like my daughter Linda's. And it's in a plastic tube, so you don't have to worry about the kids breaking it. And we take it with us on the boat in summer for that very reason. And I like it because one shampoo for all of us means we don't have all those bottles cluttering up the bathroom shelf. So here's the name again, Breck Concentrate Shampoo, the McMahon Family Shampoo. You'll like it.
I just can't get away from that fellow Ed McMahon. The United States Air Force lost one of its most famous officers last May when Brigadier General James Stewart was retired from the reserve. As a college student at Princeton, he was an engineering major but flunked math. He turned to campus dramatics, then to Broadway, and finally Hollywood. Jimmy Stewart recalls his Air Force flying, his movies, and a more recent educational contribution to Princeton during a brief visit on a movie set on location in Utah. Asking the questions in a hushed atmosphere, Monitor reporter Jay Miller.
James Stewart, what would you like to do in the future? Would you like to be an advisor to the Air Force? Could you possibly get a consultant role?
Well, I hope that I'll be able to make some kind of a contribution from here on. I don't know exactly what it'll be. I'll be on retired United States Air Force.
Mm-hmm. Well, it certainly won't mean a severing of your interest or connection with aviation. I believe you fly now, don't you?
Well, I've sort of phased out of that, too.
Have you?
Yeah.
Oh, I thought that you had a twin-engine plane that you sort of got around the country in.
Oh, yes. I've had an airplane for a long time. I had my first airplane in 1937. Mm-hmm. And then after the war, I've had several airplanes. But it's become a pretty demanding business, and when you don't have too much time to put to it to keep current, I figure it's pretty good time to get out of it.
Now, you've made numbers of Western pictures. Have you ever added up how many Westerns you've made?
Oh, gee, I don't know. I imagine 20, 25, 30.
And you've made several pictures about aviation. One of the ones that most clearly stands out in everybody's mind, of course, was the Lindbergh story. What sort of pictures, aviation or Western, gives you the most enjoyment? Or is the answer really a good script?
Well, I like the movies. I enjoy the work. I still think there's a great magic to the movies, to everything connected with the business of making motion pictures. And I enjoy it. I look forward to getting on the set. I look forward to starting another picture. And I'm one of the people that think that the movies are here to stay.
The Air Force may retire, but Hollywood is not.
Well, I hope not.
How about your university connection? You were a Princetonian. You were on the board of trustees at the university for 4 years. Are you still active in university affairs?
No, I wish I had more time to do that. But those 4 years were wonderful. It gave me a chance to really get back to the university and to really see the new problems that all universities, all higher education have today, and it was a wonderful experience.
It's certainly a fascinating expansion of universities. The universities today now seem to be concentrating on graduate school so heavily that a bachelor's degree is just like a high school diploma, it seems. And I imagine that the pressure on trustees for decisions nowadays in this area must be very severe.
It is, and it's a wonderful thing to see in a university like Princeton, the number of top-notch people that are really at the top of their field, men from the East, men from New York, and the amount of time that they devote to Princeton and to the development of Princeton.
Well, of course, what's true for Princeton would be true for many other universities in the country, too.
Yes, it certainly is, but this was sort of the first time I'd had this first-hand look at it, and it was very inspiring, very interesting.
Well, now, one final question. Another Brigadier General in the Air Force of note, I think, has just retired, Barry Goldwater. Did you get to serve with General Goldwater sometime?
No. I know General Goldwater, and I remember when he retired. Our paths never crossed in the military, though.
I think that would be a very interesting occasion when General James Stewart and General Barry Goldwater might be serving together in the Air Force.
Well, who knows? Maybe they might call us out of retirement, and here we go.
Well, we certainly hope that Hollywood never lets you get into retirement, and thank you very much for being Monitor's guest.
Thank you very much.
This is Jay Miller reporting on the set of Bandolero in southern Utah.
You're on the go with Monitor, your music and information center.
Want to know how to spark a dull evening? Tonight, why not take in a good gas station? Hop over to Citgo. Have a few gallons. Enjoy yourself. Kick a few tires. You see, at Citgo, we know what a pain in the neck just waiting around can be. So we've made Citgo a little brighter, a little cozier than the ordinary gas station. Tonight, take in a Citgo station.
You may not want to live there, but it's a nice place to visit.
That winning combination of Nancy Sinatra and Lee Hazlewood is next. Then up to the minute sports with Mel Allen. So stay close by on the Monitor Beacon. Monitor, back with you at exactly 18 minutes after the hour. Jack Haskell here, and as promised, the team of Sinatra and Hazlewood, Nancy and Lee.
I see the way the eagle flies, rode his wings far yonder in the sky, kissed the sun, touched the moon, but he left me much too soon.
Lady Bird, come on down. I'm here waiting on the ground.
one moment, Mel Allen reports on Today in Sports, plus a look at the week ahead. Monitor Sports is brought to you by VM, the voice of music, makers of stereo phonographs, tape recorders, and high-fidelity components.
VM, the voice of music, has everything but fame. You can get a whole lot more for your money if you just remember that name.
Now, I have a steel trap mind. You tell me a name like VM, the voice of music, once, it's locked in that mind forever. I have a system. They make tape recorders, right? Well, that reminds me there's a model for home office or school. Immediately, that brings to mind one model that's a regular home music center and a cordless model that fits in my briefcase and works off a rechargeable power cell. Works. They're so simple to work, any schoolboy can do it. Which means these tape recorders have got to be the biggest value since the Louisiana Purchase. Get it? To remember that name, I simply whistle a few bars of Scooby-Dooby-Loo from Louisiana U, and somehow I think this is crumbling all about me. I don't understand what's going on.
VM, the voice of music, and everything but fame. You can get a whole lot more for your money if you just remember that name.
And now at the Monitor Sports Desk, Mel Allen.
Thank you very much, Jack. Hello there, everybody. Billy Casper and Dudley Wysong have tied at 4 under par 284 at the end of the regulation 72 holes in the Hawaiian Open, have started a sudden-death playoff for the $20,000 first prize. Now let's have a look at the Monitor Professional Football Scoreboard. Baltimore preserved its status as the only undefeated team in the play for pay performers. And the way Baltimore did it ranks right up there with the classics of Hollywood, should win Johnny Unitas an Oscar nomination. He followed the script sensationally. Green Bay led 3-0 after three quarters on a 49-yard field goal by Don Chandler. The Packers then went ahead 10-0 in the fourth period on a 31-yard touchdown pass from Bart Starr to Donnie Anderson. And then Johnny Unitas went into his act with just 2 minutes and 19 seconds left in the game. He caught Alex Hawkins with a 10-yard touchdown pass. Lou Michaels missed the conversion, and so Green Bay still led 10-6. But Baltimore's Rich Volk recovered an onside kick for Baltimore on the Green Bay 34. And there was Johnny Unitas, stage center, spotlight bright. Four plays later, he tossed a 24-yard scoring pass to Willie Richardson. Michaels converted. Baltimore won it 13-10. And the clock said 1 minute, 28 seconds left to play. So that both of Baltimore's touchdowns came within 51 seconds. Could have stretched that a little, but Unitas is not too quick a reader. Anyway, as far as scripts are concerned, you don't do that much against the Packers, even if your name is Unitas. Elsewhere in the National Football League, New Orleans 31, Philadelphia 24. The first victory of the season for the new expansion club. Walt Roberts scored 3 touchdowns, returned the opening kickoff 91 yards, going 27 yards after picking up a fumble by teammate Jimmy Taylor, catching a 49-yard scoring pass from Gary Quazzo. Dallas 37, Atlanta 7, with Dan Reeves scoring 4 times, twice on passes from quarterback Don Meredith. Chicago 27, Detroit 13. The Bears' Gale Sayers scored on a 97-yard kickoff return, also ran 68 yards to set up another touchdown. St. Louis 27, Washington 21. The Cards won it by turning an interception and a fumble into a pair of fourth-period touchdowns. Cleveland 34, Pittsburgh 14. Ailing quarterback Frank Ryan sparked the Browns with a pair of touchdown passes left after the third period. Minnesota 27, New York 24. In quite a game, the Vikings trailed 24-7 in the third period, tied at 24 all in the fourth, then with less than 2 minutes left, recovered a Bill Triplett fumble right on their own 19, just as the Giants are getting ready to try a field goal or go for the victory by a TD route. In any case, they got the ball and suddenly moved quickly to the Giants 13, where Fred Cox kicked the winning field goal with just 10 seconds left. Los Angeles beat San Francisco 17-7. Dick Bass and Les Josephson each scored a touchdown. Bruce Gossett got a field goal. In the AFL, Kansas City 42, the New York Jets 18, before a record Kansas City crowd of 46,642. Len Dawson pitched a pair of touchdown passes. Boston 18, Houston 7. Gino Cappelletti kicked 3 field goals. By the way, in that Kansas City game, Mike Garrett rolled up 192 yards rushing. Buffalo 35, Miami 13. Jackie Kemp passed for 2 touchdowns. Ray Carlton scored a pair. Oakland beat Denver 21-17. Daryl LaMonica passed for 2 touchdowns. George Blanda booted a pair of field goals. At Madison Square Garden, the United States clinched the National Horse Show's International Team Championship when Kathy Kustner of Arlington, Virginia, rode Aberally to victory in the Pennsylvania National Trophy event. Looking ahead, Tuesday, the Met Intercollegiate Cross Country Championships in New York. Wednesday, the draw for the Davis Cup Interzone semifinals between South Africa and Spain. Thursday, Arnie Palmer and Jack Nicklaus defend their team title in the World Cup and International Trophy matches in Mexico City. Saturday, the $150,000 Washington, D.C. International at Laurel. And this word just in, Dudley Wysong is the victor in the golf tournament in Hawaii. He won it on the first hole in the sudden death playoff. That's what is, will be in sports, has been, is coming up. And there you are, Jack. Mel Allen here, friends.
Sounds like it all happens at the last minute, Mel. You could forget the first 59 minutes of those football games, couldn't you?
That last bit came by Lonnie Bird Sapphire.
Well, thanks, Mel. And now a word about State Farm Mutual.
George Carlin here for the makers of State Farm Insurance.
I could have sworn I seen a dove fly through Mr. McCarty's windshield.
Don't be upset, sir. Mr. McCarty has complete comprehensive insurance on hand from State Farm Mutual, the world's largest car insurer. Low-cost State Farm goes to work fast when trouble strikes. So when doves or other neurotic birds fly through Mr. McCarty's windshield, State Farm picks up the bills.
Right through the windshield.
What's wrong, sir? It wasn't your windshield.
It was my dove.
The following word on behalf of the President's Council on Physical Fitness. Tryouts for the President's All-America team have started. Every boy and girl 10 to 17 is eligible. You don't have to be a track star or a football hero. You just have to be in good physical condition. If you make the team, you'll get an award stamped with the President's seal and a badge to wear in your jacket. Remember, tryouts for the All-America team have started. You can get all the details at your school, or for a pamphlet, write President's Council on Physical Fitness, Washington, D.C. That's a new one from the James Last Orchestra, Happy Music, the happy, informative sound of Monitor reaching all America every weekend on NBC Radio. For instance, in the Amarillo, Texas area, we're heard on KGNC. It's station break time all along the party line now, so after which Monitor returns, this is Jack Haskell.
Monitor presents Bob Hope, tonight's guest star in 40 Minutes on NBC Radio.
You're at home or on the road with Monitor 67, a friendly, informative weekend companion. I'm Jack Haskell. This month marks the 50th anniversary of the Russian Revolution. In 3 minutes from now, a former Moscow correspondent, now an editor and author, tells us why he believes another Russian Revolution is not only possible, but inevitable.
Track 29. We gotta get there on time. We can afford one check and we should choose. future. Sat in a place. I used to call Bernie face. She's gonna cry.
Memories. The latest thing from the group called Harper's Bazaar, with the unmistakable influence of the old Glenn Miller arrangement of the same wonderful Tennessee Train. This month, November 1967, marks a half century of Soviet rule in Russia, an anniversary which is being loudly acclaimed throughout the communist world. How do the propaganda claims and boasts of the Soviet Union compare with the realities of life there? A new book titled Workers' Paradise Lost, 50 Years of Soviet Communism, a Balance Sheet, answers that question in a hard-hitting analytical way. Its author is Eugene Lyons, presently a senior editor of the Reader's Digest, a former Moscow correspondent for 6 years, and the author of 3 other books on life in Russia. He talked with your regular Sunday evening monitor host, Brad Crandall.
Your book is dedicated to, and I quote here, the peoples of Russia, the first and worst victims of communism. Would you explain that dedication?
Well, so many Americans and Westerners generally confuse the Russians and the Soviet government. If we're to have any sanity in our approach, we must realize at once that they are not the same, that the Russian people never chose communism, have never had an opportunity to vote on it, that they have been kept in communist chains by sheer terror, force. 2 types of terror, one almost as bad as the other. The physical terror of extermination and slave labor camps and the rest of it, and the psychological and intellectual terror of constant indoctrination, of thought control, of denial of access to alternative thoughts or ideas. When I was in Moscow myself, or possibly don't, that I went there as a great sympathizer of the Soviet cause. I was a very young man. And as I got to know and admire the Russian people, in the same measure, I turned against their government.
Mm-hmm.
No one had to prove to me that the Soviet people didn't love their chains, as some reporters insist, because before long I was beginning to see through their eyes and feel with their hearts. And they are the first and the worst victims of communism. And I
not communism, in fact, but communism as a word to cover a multitude of sins.
That's right. The true name, of course, would be a totalitarian police state. Not one of the founders of communism would recognize the distortion that now passes by its name.
Let me, if I may, get into the area to which a certain amount of the book, indeed the bulk of the book, is involved, where it compares myths about Russian communism with the facts about the same system as it exists. For example, the theory that the masses supported the Bolshevik Revolution, fact or fiction?
It's fiction, and so obvious to anyone who reads a little of the early history that it hardly needs testifying to. They've had only one free election, and that was within a month or so after the Soviets took power.
What are your personal opinions, Mr. Lyons, on the significance of Svetlana's defection?
The significance of her defection is as a symbol of the defection of a large segment of the entire Soviet intelligentsia. She recognizes herself. For reasons of her own, she chose defection. Others have chosen defection, but the great majority of them prefer to remain home and continue the struggle now.
And to try and make things better.
To try to fight for what interests them as intellectuals, which is primarily the freedom of expression and freedom of conscience.
Let me get a couple of things regarding the future here, sir, in our limited time. A good many journalists have talked about the possibility of a Soviet-American alliance against Red China. What do you think?
I think that it's an attempt to whistle in the dark. Let us assume for the moment, and it won't take me long to give you that assumption, that Russia and China go to war. What will be Russia's purpose? Russia's purpose will be to reestablish communism on the Soviet model.
What Soviet will be, control, right.
Soviet control. Why could we be allied with them for any purpose of that sort? It's contradictory on the face of it.
Now, what about the possibility of a showdown between the ordinary people and the Kremlin, the inevitable discussion which always comes up of a counter-revolution, if you like, against the Kremlin leadership? Is there any possibility for this?
Not only a possibility, I personally, and possibly I stand alone among so-called specialists who believe it, consider a revolution in Russia inevitable. It's only a matter of time. I do not believe that a totalitarian government can evolve into its opposite. If there is to be a liberation of the Russian people, or even a partial liberation, it will not come, as so many of our wishful thinkers believe, by gradual relaxation. That relaxation, and there has been some since the death of Stalin, does not affect the essence of the matter, which is a total monopoly of power by one small group. Nothing that they have conceded, either in terms of permissiveness in writing or in terms of permissiveness in any other area, has made the slightest dent in this monopoly of power. And that monopoly can be broken only by force. And when it comes, it will come so suddenly that we will be as astonished as the world was when the Hungarians turned on their government. The ingredients, the inflammable stuff is there. What will set it off, no one knows. I have an abiding faith in the underlying decency of the Russian people. The very fact that as soon as they were given a little leeway after the death of Stalin, they immediately broke forth into a chorus of poetry that dealt with love, the soul, compassion, clear proof that 50 years of indoctrination, total indoctrination, when not another idea was allowed in, has destroyed the essence of their character.
Thank you very much, sir.
You're welcome, sir. I wish we could talk some more.
Our guest has been Eugene Lyons, author of a new book which looks at communism in Russia, from the Bolshevik Revolution to its 50th anniversary in November of this year. Mr. Lyons' book is titled Workers' Paradise Lost, 50 Years of Soviet Communism, a Balance Sheet.
If you're on the road right now, the safe driving advice of a nationally known expert may very well come in handy. He's only several minutes away, and he has some startling reminders about nighttime driving. So stay with us on the Monitor Beacon. You're back with Monitor at 13 minutes before the hour. I'm Jack Haskell, and the lady with the vibrant voice is Vicki Carr.
I tell myself, what's done is done. I tell myself, don't be a fool. Play the field, have a lot of fun. It's easy when you play it cool. I tell myself, don't be a chump. Who cares? Let him stay away. That's when the phone rings, and I jump. And as I grab the phone, I pray. Let it be him, for dear love.
pick the pieces off the floor. Put my heart on the shelf again. You'll never hurt me anymore. I'm not a puppet on a string. I'll find somebody else someday. That's when the phone rings. And once again, I start to pray.
Highway and automobile safety has occupied the interest and concern of the nation on an almost daily basis for the past several months. With the approach of winter driving conditions, motorists will have to be especially careful in the operation of their vehicles. William J. Toth, professor of safety education at New York University, examines the conditions of our nation's back roads, the hazards of nighttime driving, and passes on some advice to teenage drivers as he chats with Monitor reporter Charlie Holmes.
Professor Toth, main highways, I believe, in our country are kept in pretty good condition, but how about secondary roads?
This is the big bugaboo of the Highway Traffic Department. You know, our new interstate highways, when they are completed in about 1970, they're going to take about 20% of all the traffic that we have, which means that 80% is still going to be traveling on our back roads, and these back roads must be maintained.
What's the matter with them?
Actually, most states and people that are in charge of this, counties and townships and so on, just claim they do not have enough money. The cost of materials, the cost of labor and so on has risen to a point where we have concentrated on our main highways, building new ones, and we have forgot to maintain the other ones. And this is where a big problem is.
I understand there are not enough signs, for instance, for sharp curves and crossroads and that sort of thing.
Exactly right. These are very expensive. And one point I'd like to make at this time is the general public, and I'm not blaming them all, but there's a certain element in the public that go out and destroy signs. People ride along and shoot holes through the signs. They throw beer cans through signs. They throw other objects and destroy signs. And these signs have to be replaced, and unfortunately, sometimes while they're being replaced, somebody has an accident because it's not there.
Could cost a life.
Very truly.
I know many businessmen who travel at night and feel that this is the safest time to drive, is it?
No. Statistically, this is the worst time to drive.
Why?
Accidents are up about 3 times as much as they are during the day, and yet you only have about half the traffic, mainly because there is a lack of vision. There's a lack of light. Most people overdrive their headlights. In other words, your headlights will show out, say, 300 feet, and you may be traveling at a speed that is something suddenly showed up on the road ahead of you, you would hit your brakes, and it would take you over 300 feet to stop, so you would hit him. For instance, at 60 miles an hour, it'll take you over the length of a football field to bring that car to a complete stop under emergency conditions and ideal conditions.
If your youngster were age 17 and about to drive his car, and he's passed his license and everything else, what sound advice would you give him?
Well, I think one of the first things, I'll step back a little farther, it's the same thing as a mother wrote to a general in the Army and said, my son is getting ready to come into the Army. What can I do as a parent to help him return from the Army? The general wrote back and says, make sure he gets a good course in driver education.
I'll be darned.
And this is interesting because the Army has found, and so the Air Force, that their biggest problem is the automobile. And normally the off-duty automobile are their people. And if I had a son, I would make sure that he had a good course in driver education, one that included practice driving and had a good classroom session, that he would get a good indication as to what this problem is all about.
Thank you, William J. Toth, Professor of Safety Education at New York University, for this interesting discussion of highway haymakers, an article in the current edition of Science and Mechanics magazine. Come again, won't you?
I will.
This is Charlie Holmes for Monitor.
Sound on Monitor. Well, it may seem early to mention Christmas, but it's not if you're sending packages overseas. The Defense Department has announced that packages weighing over 5 pounds destined for military personnel in Vietnam must be mailed before November 11th, and that's next Saturday. You've got until December 1st on the smaller packages, letters, and cards. But if it weighs 5 pounds or more, and it's headed for Vietnam for Christmas, mail it before next Saturday. That's a new one from the Johnny Harris Orchestra. Where is Love? Wherever news is, there's NBC. Keep up with this fast-moving weekend world through NBC Monitor News on the Hour, which is next. This is Jack Haskell.